Hello, this is Russ Chianelli. Keith's panel is on vacation, and today we have an organometallic chemist, and Keith is going to miss being here and listening to him. And his name is Dr. Daniel Mendiola. He's Department of Chemistry, the presidential chair for the University of Pennsylvania near Philadelphia. Welcome to Science Studio, Daniel.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Here on Science Studio, one of the things we like to do is before you begin to explain your research a little bit more to our fans and students that are out there, how did you get into science? We're always asking that question.
It's actually doesn't go that far. I wasn't really interested in chemistry per se or science, but perhaps the moment that caught my attention for chemistry, the scientific aspects relating to chemistry, was the colors of materials, the colors of compounds, why colors would change according to what element or what ligand was bonding to this metal ion. So I think that's really what caught my attention.
Can you tell us exactly the first compounds that you noticed the color change in that turned you on?
Boy, that's a difficult question to think really far back. Maybe the color of the leaf was perhaps my first curiosity in terms of why is it green? Why does it turn brown after you pull the leaf from the tree? Things like this.
It reminds me of the case of indigo, which is in everybody's genes and so on, nitrogen-containing molecule. It turns out that if you reduce it, you can dissolve it in water as long as there's no air.
Mm-hmm.
So when it's reduced, it's soluble in water, and you keep the air out, and you can keep it in liquid. But as soon as you let the air in, here come puffs of blue. It's a beautiful experiment that is easily done. And part of this was because we've worked on Mayan pigments, as people listening here know, is that the archaeologists asked, how did the Mayans get a reducing agent to be able to dye cloths? And that's a question that I'm going to leave to the audience to listen to or look up. So give us some other examples of how you got turned on to science and the path you took.
So I would say that it was mostly inspirational. I had a fantastic high school teacher that
showed you color changes all the time?
Didn't show me color changes. He did show me the sodium explosion experiment, which I really enjoyed. So his name was Jack Nutter. He is, in fact, I think he's now retired, but he's in the town of Ovid, Michigan, which is right in the middle of, pretty much in the middle of Michigan. And he really took me under his wing and would spend time with me every day, Monday through Fridays, an hour before school began. And he would teach me problems, how to solve problems, and that really got me interested in chemistry because I had a really difficult time trying to grasp how to solve problems in terms of chemical balancing equations. Believe it or not, I did struggle with chemistry in high school. So he really took me under his wing, and he kind of guided me in that direction. Now, he wasn't really pushing me to become a chemist, but he knew that I was interested in chemistry, but he also wanted me to do well. So I really thank Jack Nutter for that.
Oh, that's very nice. Okay, thanks, Jack, for that, for bringing him here to the Science Studio today. Okay, so then that was high school.
That was high school, yes.
And then you decided to go to school to get a degree. When did you decide to get your PhD and why?
So I went to Michigan State University. I ended up doing research with Kim Dunbar, and she was also an inspiration for chemistry. But the day I decided to apply to graduate programs across the U.S. was the day I realized that I didn't want to go into an MD-PhD program. So I was very fixed.
In other words, you didn't want to be a doctor.
I did not want to be a doctor. I also found out that when you get interviewed by these medical schools, you have to pretty much pay your own way.
So, but the question is, because I have students all the time that are trying to choose between an MD and PhD and all that kind of stuff. How did you get into the idea that you might be a doctor?
I thought an MD-PhD was something I could be qualified for because it was a free. They would pay your tuition throughout your
so is this
degree.
A question of tuition cost?
Yes.
I mean,
believe it or not, that's what it was.
The reason I ask that is that a lot of students, I always ask them, Do you want to be an MD because you want to help people? Or did your grandmother tell you that's what you have to do?
There were two reasons. Yeah,
have a family impulse. You know?
For me, there were two reasons. One, it was the economics of it, which I'm not going to lie about. It's a career that it's quite rewarding if you do well. And the other was I really liked the research aspects of it, but it was a free experience. It would have been a free experience because if you get into an MD PhD, essentially you're covered for it.
So then you decided that you were going to get your PhD in chemistry. Forget about the MD. When did that happen?
That happened when I so this was the beginning of my senior year. Senior year in college. And my undergraduate mentor at that time, Kim Dunbar, approached me and said that she thought that I would be suitable to apply to the top programs in the U.S. for bioinorganic chemistry, which is what I was doing research on. And she suggested to me several research groups, one at MIT that I was interested in, the other one at UCLA. They're really pretty much spread all over the U.S., and I applied to particular programs because of that specific name that she gave me.
So tell us a little bit about, I know that we're going to talk next about MIT experience, but bioinorganic, what were you working on?
I was working on anti-cancer metal-based drugs of heavy elements like rhenium and rhodium. And these compounds possessed like a purine base that would coordinate to them. And the goal was, could these molecules intercalate into DNA and cause distortions in the DNA such that it would eventually lead to cell death?
You know, I know that people that I worked with had computer programs that showed how the molecules bound to DNA. Did you ever use one of those?
No, this is early 1990s, so there was no such
thing. Well, this was early, too, and it turns out that the fun discussion I had with them, because I was working with these guys, developed a program to do it, saying if you go to the witch doctors in Central America, they have a better track record out of discovering cancer than you guys do. Because it's a pretty tricky thing to build a DNA string and bring the molecules in. But of course, we might say that when we talk about CRISP, I think is the right word, that's what's happening today.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, please tell us how you got into MIT and what you did at MIT.
So around early January, that's when I received the notification that I was admitted into the graduate program. And I was fixed in going and doing research at MIT with a chemist by the name of Steve Lippard. And that was the original goal.
Lippard or Lippard?
Lippard.
Lippard.
Lippard. So Steve Lippard was the name that came up because he was one of the pioneers of bioinorganic chemistry. He had done enormous research in the context of cisplatin, which is a anti-cancer drug that has saved many lives. And it operates, again, by this intercalation and distortion in the DNA backbone. And so that was the goal. But once I was admitted into MIT and once I decided to head east to Boston and Cambridge, I found out that that was not really what I wanted to do. I began to read more of the bioinorganic aspects. I also began to see other research taking place in organometallic that I found quite interesting, just basically making molecules that were very beautiful molecules. So my interest kind of shifted gradually over the period of the first semester when I was there, and I began to look more into synthesis and organometallic chemistry as another possible research endeavor.
So it was actually what you just said, which I thought was quite interesting, was it was a spatial beauty that attracted you to shapes of molecules.
Shapes and symmetry, really. That's what caught my eye.
The shapes and symmetry. And that sort of reminds me of the start of this when you talked about the color attracted you. So now it was shapes and symmetry, which is related to color and, you know, just the appearance, which I think a lot of chemists feel the same way as you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you talk about a buckyball or something like that, I mean, it's just something that inspires the imagination.
That's right. In fact, symmetry is one of the beauties of chemistry because it's kind of like the crossroads of math and science, math and chemistry, where they unify. They have some mutual aspects of that relates to each. So I really found symmetry, color changes, coordination environments. Those all were quite interesting to me at that point. And to make matters even more attractive was that a young professor at that time by the name of Kit Cummings taught a course that I took during the fall semester. This was during the fall semester of 92. He basically made synthesis fun. He made it really interesting in the context of symmetry, as you had mentioned, in the context of color, why molecules react, orbitals. And he really pointed out some of the gold nuggets out there in terms of chemical research that had taken place from the last 50 or 70 years.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Where can you find the world's tallest men? That's obvious. On the NBA court, right? True, but scientists wanted to trace the origins of tall people.
Among the tallest NBA players are Slavko Vranjes from Montenegro at 7 feet 5 inches and Rick Smits, the Duncan Dutchman, at 7 feet 4 inches.
It turns out they do come from countries where we find the tallest men, in the Netherlands, Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Montenegro.
Why does this area of the Balkans harbor a cluster of tall people? Their genetics point back to the Upper Paleolithic Gravidian culture.
These people were big game hunters whose diet included mammoth, bison, horse, and reindeer. They lived 10 to 50,000 years ago during the last glacial maximum.
The Gravidian males measured almost 6 feet, towering over other ancient males who averaged at or below 5 feet. Their height is partly due to an abundant source of protein and the presence of high calcium levels in water sources in the Dinaric Alps.
But genetics also play a factor. A researcher studied 3,000 Bosnian and Herzegovinian students and found many carry a common haplogroup called IM170.
A haplogroup is a group of genes inherited together that share a common ancestor. This haplogroup is found in people from the Balkans, with the highest frequency seen in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Males here average 6'1", making them the world's tallest.
To confirm this ancient link, they identified this haplogroup in the remains of a Gravidian who lived more than 30,000 years ago.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Now we're back with Daniel Mendiola, professor of chemistry from University of Pennsylvania, who's talking about his research at MIT. And now I think what we'd like to do is have you begin to speak about your current research and why you like it and why it's important.
So this all began back in the early 2000s. I had an interest in doing olefin polymerization, and a student by the name of Brad Bailey, in fact my first PhD student, decided to make some molecules that could polymerize ethylene to make these polymers. And at the time, we were thinking just very broadly of, can we reduce or oxidize a compound, and would that then generate an active catalyst? That was the goal. So very, very broadly defined. And Brad found out instead that these were awful polymerization catalysts. Thank goodness. I think about it now. And he discovered instead that these redox approaches, removing an electron or adding an electron, would instead result in the formation of metal carbon multiple bonds, which is really the topic of my research, the main topic of my research program. And from there on, we began to see that these molecules that contained either alkylidenes, which relates to metal carbon double bonds, or alkylidienes, which contain metal carbon triple bonds, were quite reactive. They could activate molecules, including methane, at room temperature, dehydrogenate methane at room temperature to make carbenes. And that's really where the research took off. And so this is where we began to look at, can we utilize these to transform alkanes that typically are just burned away because they have very high volatilities, or they're just simply used as solvents because there's really no value added to them in the context of making chemicals of value to industry, as well as utilize methane without burning it. So that was really the goal. And so now we're finding out that these molecules that we just made and Brad made back in the early 2000s can catalytically convert alkanes, volatile alkanes, to olefins, which are the building block for a lot of commodity products. We're also finding out that we can transform methane to olefins, which is industrially a very important reaction. We can't do that yet catalytic, but we have ways, we have ideas, and some plans to do this with, more importantly, I should say, with base metals that are not that are earth abundant. So that's pretty much the summary of the research in my group. It's very fundamental, but we happen to be lucky that we're in a methane boom era, and so that's our twist, that we're selling it in the context of methane functionalization, alkane functionalization, and hopefully instead of burning things, we could have a more controlled way of activating them and transforming them into more useful commodity reagents. That's really the goal.
You're really hitting a nail on the head with something that I'm quite interested in, which I'll tell you in a moment. But one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, you said Brad Bailey decided. And one of the things that I've learned here working with students at the university, and there was a famous Nobel Prize winner who was asked, how do you pick your students? And his answer was, I picked students, I looked in their background, and if they didn't take a risk somewhere, I didn't want them. I wanted students that could take risks. So did he decide to do this, or did you just tell him to do it?
I really think that it was a motivation. He wanted to approach it from a different direction. I might have provided ideas. I don't quite know who's to be credited, whether it was him that he tried it on his own or whether I suggested these reactions. Quite honestly, I don't know. I do know that he tried many different things prior to that, so I think he did take the risk.
So he was turned on by it, and that point I'm making here, too, is I always think the best students are ones that come back to you and say, you didn't tell me to do this, but look at these crystals.
Mm-hmm. Or you told me to do this, but it didn't work, and therefore I did it this way, and it worked.
Right. That's
those
right.
Those are the terrific students, the ones that take the change.
Those are the ones that take a risk, by
and
the
take
way.
A risk, yes.
I know that when I had employees, that one guy from Stanford just kept coming in and said, I want you to write down exactly what you want me to do tomorrow. And he didn't succeed. And he was a superstar from Stanford, too. So students who are listening out there, make sure that you tell your advisors, I want to try this. Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about is we have a program here where we, you know, basically in catalysts, where we do methane reforming with CO2, solar.
Oh, yeah.
Because all over the world, the pipes are flaming, the petroleum wells are burning the CO2 and methane. And I got involved in this when I read an article in the Wall Street Journal saying that every night in Siberia, the Russians burn as much energy from their wells as the entire east coast of the United States uses for transportation. Hmm. So can you talk a little bit more about methane and why it's a problem?
Well, I mean, I'll give you some numbers. For instance, in the early 2000s, it's been estimated, and it depends on the source of methane, because the price of methane has different value depending on where it comes from. As you might know, if it's coming from Alaska, the price might be much more expensive per liter than if it's coming from Texas. And so,
yeah, that was the problem that in Russia was that it was so far away that they couldn't afford to liquefy.
They couldn't distribute. But it's estimated, and now the prices, the value might be doubled. It's estimated that about $50 to $100 million in the U.S. alone are burnt away annually because they want to convert methane, which is about 85% more insulating than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. They want to burn it away to CO2 and water. Otherwise, they would release this directly into the atmosphere. And it also has a short time span, so it's going to have more environmental impact in the next 20 years. If it does get released into the atmosphere. But here's the number that's staggering. 9 billion tons of methane are leaked away into the atmosphere. It's estimated through the process of extraction, delivery, and storage.
What that means when you're talking about this, for example, when you drill a well down and there's actually pressure release from the
fracking core, process.
From the fracking. And so forth. And so you're saying that 9 million tons is just going into the atmosphere from fracking and digging and what other things?
Through piping and through storage.
Leaking pipes.
Leaking pipes. And this is a major issue that the petrochemical industry is certainly looking into. Can we have better sensors for leaks? To the parts per billion of leaks. Very low pressure leaks also can cause major issues.
Yeah, so if it's low pressure, but it's leaking all the time, you get tons of methane going into the atmosphere. And the current is telling us, the current science is telling us that methane is a more insulating molecule.
Yes, it's a more effective greenhouse gas. It really holds the heat approximately 85% more than carbon dioxide.
Yeah, I mean, this is another subject that Keith and I always talk about is, global warming and so on. And the only thing I say is that I know, have a colleague here who talked about dust storms and that were caused by droughts. And he went back to the Roman Empire and taking from the literature when there was a drought and when there wasn't a drought. And there's a straight line between droughts and dust storms. Mm. And so the only reason I bring that up is that I would like to know, when we're talking about global warming, what the sun, the heater, has been doing for 2,000 years, and then work on that.
Yeah, it's ideal if you can use the sunlight to convert products to others. That's certainly the cleanest form of energy that we can possibly think of.
But I'm talking about the cooling of the earth and the heating of the earth and what has the sun been doing, because we know before there was any CO2 production or methane production, that the earth was cooling sometimes and heating sometimes, and the answer is the sun.
The sun, yeah. So it really depends on, well, you're saying globally, because, it's one of these, well, I can't really comment on it because it's one of these questions that relates more to the geological aspects. Are we looking at the northern hemisphere versus the southern hemisphere? How does the sun affect one versus the other? Honestly, I don't know. It's folks don't believe in global warming, and the gas
deniers.
Is really affecting the temperature worldwide.
But. Well, the only point is, whatever you're talking about, get the politics out and keep the science in, is what I want to say. So as we're beginning to run out of time, can you talk to us a little bit more about where your research will be going, or where do you think it will be important?
So
you mentioned a little bit about cancer treatments.
So no, we don't have my research is not going to be directed towards cancer treatment. That was more of the inspirational work that I did as an undergrad and that led to my application to several grad schools and graduate programs. But I would say that one of the directions that I'd like to go into is, can we convert gases into liquid fuels? And can we use these liquid fuels not by burning them but by transforming them into materials that are more value, that have more value added to it? Can we get away from the prehistoric approach of burning things? That's really where I'd like to make an impact. Instead of burning it, can we use it in a more effective way?
Make molecules that are more valuable.
That's right.
Using your materials.
I think, there's a statement that I often use, and that is, man doesn't have to run out of stones to change from the Stone Age to the Neolithic Age. Right? So we hopefully won't run out of natural resources to come up with ideas that could utilize the sun, for instance, as an energy source, or for energy storage. That's another one that I'm really interested in, batteries, the future of batteries and energy storage, which is also a very important
Yeah, I agree
area.
With that too. Also one of my interests, but there was a time when we thought about using methane to drive cars too, store the methane, go and pump up your tank again.
So in terms of the burning of methane, using methane as a fuel, say for powering vehicles, I would say that is a better alternative compared to burning coal and crude oil and refined oil, but it's just simply buying us time. It's not going to solve the energy issue of renewable resources. CO2 is still going to be an issue, release of CO2 in water. I think we need to think more far beyond this, and that is, can we can we extract the bonds, the energies in these CH bonds more effectively and controllably? And can we use methane, for instance, as a precursor or starting material to make liquid fuels? Can we use it as a carbon unit to build up molecules or materials? Or could we use the best idea would be to just use sunlight to do transformations involving the breaking and making of chemical bonds and also storage of chemical energy.
Yeah, I think that's a good picture. Are there any other molecules besides methane that you think we have to work on?
There are. It's not a big breakthrough, but ethane is also one that I'm really interested in, and that is the petrochemical industry uses ethane for steam cracking processes that form olefins. And basically they just crack, they burn, they break the C-C bond under very high temperatures. That's resulting in a lot of CO2 formation through steam reforming and the burning of fossil fuels. But we like to be able to pull selectively two hydrogens out of ethane and be able to make olefins like ethylene
so
at
you
room
think
temperature.
Of,
that would save a lot of energy.
Ethane is a source of reactive hydrogen for other applications.
I think so. I think it does have the hydrogens there to further use. Hydrogen as a fuel is an alternative as well because you release only water upon combustion. So can we grab hydrocarbons that this world is providing in vast amounts? And rather than burning them ultimately uncontrollably to CO2 and water, which are thermodynamic sinks, can we begin to construct more reactive bonds, C-C pi bonds, and make hydrogen, which is potentially a very clean fuel under mild conditions?
Okay, well, we're running out of time, so I would like to give you the opportunity to speak to our audience, which I said is a faculty and students and so on listening to this, with any other comments you'd like to make.
I'd just like to make a comment to the grad students, the scientists out there that are really in the trenches making the doing the reactions and trying to discover new science, is that whenever you have an idea, test it out. Whenever you have a mixture of products that you think it's going to be a dead end, you might find it that sometimes that little impurity found in the product formation, or that little impurity as part of the starting material, might actually be the solution to the problem. So never throw away your reaction mixtures.
Never throw away your reaction mixtures. Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And I want to thank you listening to Science Studio and Daniel Mendiola for being on Science Studio. And I would like to thank Loren Terrazas, our producer. And sorry, Keith, that you missed this one, because this is your area. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Russ.